Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today we're here with Mr. Sam LaCrosse, author of Value Economics, The Study of Identity. And with that, I'd like to welcome Sam. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate it, brother. Looking forward to it.
What was very unique about your book and what really gravitated to me, particularly in the conversation that we've had both today and the previous conversation we had, was just how genuine you come across. So talk a little bit about your inspiration for writing this book and why you felt the need to put yourself out there like you did.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. That means a lot coming from someone like you. And I respect you highly, as I said last time. And I think that we've developed a good friendship over the few times you've talked and everything. So that's been awesome. I'm very much looking forward to what you have coming next as well, because it's really exciting. But I would say the inspiration, I would say, for the book and the mindset behind the book come from two different things. So I'll start with the book first, because that's what I'm here to, you know, kind of talk about today. And so I had the initial seed planted in my head from my mother in the summer of 2019. We were kind of having a conversation. My mom's a really intelligent woman. She's very articulate with her thoughts and ideas. She does a bunch of other things. And then the conversation kind of spun generally into a discussion about belief and about why we believe things and kind of everything like that. And so she basically kind of threw it offhanded comment at me that says, you know, I'm turning 25 in October, so I'm 24. And I was, I believe, 21 at the time that I was 21 at the time. Yeah. And I, you know, she said, you know, you guys, you know, Gen Z, you guys really don't believe in anything. And I was like, well, you know, that kind of hurts on one hand, but at the same time is like, is it true? Like, is that statement true or is it not true? And so that was kind of the initial question that I set out to answer from the rest of it. So I was thinking about some things in my head, and I thought about, you know, generally the relationship between value and sacrifice. And I basically kind of came up with a lazy argument that says, like, okay, the more you value something, the more you're probably going to have to sacrifice to get that something. The less you value something, the less you're probably going to sacrifice to get that something. And I just, you know, kind of stored it in the back of my brain. And then that was kind of it for the time being. And so fast forward to October of 2019 of that year, I was sitting in my economics class. I was doing all that other kind of stuff. And so I remember sitting in that type of an environment and looking at, you know, we were in a macroeconomics class and I was a senior in college. And, you know, I was having mild senioritis. I was in there with some of my boys. And we were just kind of in the back room. And the professor was a really cool guy and he liked all of us and stuff. And we were kind of, you know, back there and talking and stuff. So I was, and we were kind of looking at supply and demand curves, I think. And right. So we were looking at, you know, basically the two lines across the middle between everything else, the graph kind of encloses everything. And I kind of had like a red pill moment and I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is a relationship between two things. That's a relationship between two things. So what if I use economic models to model it and see if it works, to kind of provide a visualization aspect and provide somewhat scientific proof of what I talk about. So I started my blog, goreadthisblog.com, in January of 2020. So that was my first post, was actually turned out to be chapter 4 of the book, The Value Sacrifice Trade-Off. And so I basically took that and I ran with it. And I remember when I, you know, basically said, like, I, you know, had a blog and everything, people like checked out the first post and whatever. And I remember specifically my one good friend, Lene Brentley, she read it and she said that, you know, she was like, I am at the gym right now. I want to get in better shape. So I value getting in shape. So I'm going to sacrifice my time to go get in shape. And I'm like, that's exactly what I was hoping for. So like, yes, like at least one person doesn't think I'm like, you know, totally batshit nuts or whatever. And so that was the first thing. And I had a good time writing too. I was, you know, because I was a finance major in college and I was kind of doing it more off the scenario that I wanted to get a good job after college. I really wasn't, right, you know, finance nut or whatever. There are finance nuts. It just wasn't one of those. And so I was more interested in the psychology aspect of everything, how people thought about things, like kind of talking with people, having, you know, deeper conversations about stuff. And so I enjoyed writing that post and kind of linking it to what I learned throughout that 4 years. And so the next month in February, I was like, okay, I did chapter 1 last month. I'll do chapter 2 this month. And then chapter 2 turned into chapter 3 and chapter 4 and chapter 5 and chapter 6. And I think I got all the way up to chapter 7 or 8. And I remember I was at that point, like in the summer of 2020, when all the shit was going down, I kind of, you know, had a bunch of other stuff with, you know, going on outside of the world that we all did with COVID and that crazy summer that we had in 2020. And I was looking at all this stuff and I was like, okay, I think I have something here. And I remember talking to my parents in October of 2020. And I said, like, you know, guys, I really think I should go for this. I really think I should have this book and, or I should go write this book. And to their credit, they were like, do it, go ahead and do it. And yeah. So then I had basically the book structured and I had the ideas for the central concepts. I just needed a through line to connect all of them through other than all the other concepts. And basically what that through line turned out to be was the question of identity. And I think that especially among younger people and probably among people in your generation and generations above us, I actually don't know how old you are, so you might be my age. I really don't know. I'm assuming you're older than I am if you're a doctor. But I think the other thing is all that other kind of stuff. And so the big question I think with my generation right now is, who are we as people and who are we as individual people, not as a group of people, but as individual people? And I thought that question was very interesting. And so back to the overall mindset and how that links to the book, I was raised in a family. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I was raised in a very nucleic family structure. So I had was fortunate enough to have two parents in the household, two siblings, and then I also had like my grandparents nearby, my dad's parents, my mom's mother lived right by me as well. I had cousins around me, aunts, uncles, close family friends, those type of things. So I was always in a very nurturing environment in the sense of what I believed in as a family unit and as a person. And I remember my dad specifically would come home almost every night from work when he wasn't traveling, and he would basically have like a bang the table moment every night of like values, like you got to do something about your values and whatever. And so I remember like I knew what an abstract values were and what individual values were, but I don't know if I could have defined the term until I started writing the book, because it was so self-evident to me growing up that it would be like, so I proposed this in other interviews I've done where I would basically say like, Jay, if I asked you to define a circle, how would you define a circle? And
Just
so like,
try to.
yeah, it's like you probably, and you know what a circle is. You're a very intelligent guy, obviously, but we would probably say like, what is the word for word definition of a circle? I think we all would have trouble with that. And so there's, it's things that are so self-evident. So that was an interesting question to me. And so I was always brought up to be very integrity focused, very honest, very value driven as a person. And one of my biggest values, as I say, basically throughout the book is, authenticity, self-awareness, discipline, all that kind of stuff. And in my writing style, in my podcasting style, I don't listen to this podcast or don't read this blog into my book. I always had a rule where I would tell the truth. I dedicated the book to those who tell the truth. That was my dedication. And so, because I believe telling the truth is a very admirable thing to do, especially now. And I always said that I would never say something that I don't mean. I would never say something that I knew wasn't true. And I would always kind of, basically say that throughout the entire book. And I remember that I had a note. I had like a, the notes app on your phone. I pulled it up when I was going through my final strip of my editing process before I handed the manuscript into Scribe Media, the publisher that I went with. And I had a note on my phone that says, if you read something in this manuscript and you find yourself pulling any punches, take it out and rewrite it as you want to write it. And I remember because I wanted to just, I wanted to swing as hard as I possibly could. I wanted to say exactly what I meant in pure, raw, unfiltered fashion and really go forward from there. So in terms of my writing style and how that, portrayed into the whole holistic definition of the book, I know it's kind of a long answer, but it was kind of the process of the book melding with my personality, which is a very forthright, I believe, honest person who really kind of tells people, gives people honest critique and strips everything down to the bare metal and basically says, like, okay, here's what we have to do. Here's how this actually is. And then here's how we can build on top of that. And I think the book is, does a pretty good job of that, I think.
No, I couldn't agree more, to be honest with you, because the thing that really stuck out about your writing style were these short, powerful sentences. And you would convey abstract concepts in a way that related pop culture to your own story, your own personal narrative, if you will. And I thought that that was really interesting because it was never just a random reference here or a random reference there. The references carried with you as we follow you through your journey. And I thought that was really nice because when certain individuals from the pop culture world would come in, like Chris Farley, like a Tupac, I would always think back to where you talked about it before and how you're talking about it now. And I'm curious about that decision of putting in pop culture with self-identity. Is that kind of how you're looking at the world? This kind of yin and yang, inside and outside, where your own development mirrors pop culture?
So I've always been, so it's interesting because the book, and you've read it, so I don't know what you would think about this idea that I'm proposing now. A lot of people, when I've talked about that, have taken it in a political context, and I frankly don't think the book is a political book. I think, I think politics, I've written about politics before. And I think politics are very boring. They're very stale. I don't really enjoy writing about that kind of stuff. So I reference, two or three political things inside of the entire book. But I write about culture. And I think culture is much more fascinating than politics are, than political systems and government, business, all that other kind of stuff. I think culture is fascinating because there's that Andrew Breitbart quote that says, you know, politics is downstream from culture, and that's absolutely correct. So I think if you want to really get a pulse of how the society and how America is really operating, you look at culture. You don't look at government. You don't look at business. You look at everything else. And I think the biggest relatability, or in terms of the relatability aspect, is pop culture in a lot of ways. And that's how I like to, you know, kind of, that's how I kind of saw the world in a lot of ways. And growing up, I remember I was exposed to a lot of, I remember I started reading from like the time I was, I think, like 18 months old or 2 years old or something. Like my mom said, I read very, very early, and I read very often. I still read a lot of stuff. And so I was always absorbing a lot of different stuff. And I remember that translated a lot into the movies and the TV shows that I watched as well, because I was exposed. I remember, you know, being very young, probably about less than 10 years old easily, and I'd be watching, you know, these great films. And I remember watching Star Wars and the Indiana Jones movies and a bunch of other things on, you know, TV with my parents and everything like that. And I remember watching these great musicals and everything like Grease. And I remember, you know, the first time I watched The Godfather when I was 12 years old, that moment changed my life forever. And I remember, you know, seeing all of these things piecing together, and I fell in love with really storytelling and characters and all this other kind of stuff. And I thought that that was the most effective way to communicate something, was to tell a story. Because when you watch a great film, or you read a great book, or you do anything like that, it gives you something more than just reading a great article or something like that. It gives you more than just, you know, kind of going and like looking through a fact statement or something like that. There's a romance to it that I think is very, very interesting. And I need to read more fiction because I need to exercise those muscles more. But I think the greatest storytellers in the real world are people in pop culture, because they live these fascinating and fantastic lives. And you can see yourselves in these people, because usually a lot of them have very, they come from very rough beginnings, very scrappy beginnings. They had to claw their way to the top of an industry, whether that is in medicine, to your profession. Guy grows up poor in an urban neighborhood, and he wants to make it out, so he wants to become a doctor. So then, like Dr. Ben Carson is a great example of the same thing, where he grew up, and he was a very violent child. He was illiterate. His mom made him read the dictionary. And now, you know, fast forward 60 or 70 years later, he's one of the most influential, in my opinion, influential thinkers in America. Like, he's advising, you know, policy throughout the United States. And no matter what you think of him, his political affiliation, you can't deny that he's been a very successful person because of those reasons. And I
Agreed.
think the same is true of someone like Oprah Winfrey, or somebody like Chris Farley, or somebody like that. These people are very, very fascinating where they come from. So I think that, and we don't have a royal family. We don't have a monarchy. So we either look up to people in the culture, or people who are in positions of established power, like CEOs, presidents, senators, or people in movies, or people in TV shows, or people who are influencers on TikTok or Instagram, or whoever have you. And I think that that's a really powerful way to captivate an audience, because we see ourselves in those people and we want to be like those people. It's just a matter of who those people are. And I think by hitting a broad variety of that spectrum, you can really tell a compelling story and make people listen to you in a way where I would be talking about individual values that could probably be more relatable than just me talking at you versus me telling a story and looping you in and wrapping you into that story itself.
Yeah, it's very well said. And a few quotations from your book actually stick out as you were talking. And this is, and I'm just going to put the pages in here because I would encourage anybody listening to the podcast to purchase the book and read it. On page
Thank you, sir.
55, you say, true values get distorted in the pursuit of greater values. You talk about on page 38 the notion of primary and secondary values. So it makes sense that you talk about these cultural icons because they are examples illustrating the points that you're making in a way that you feel can be relatable. It's funny how what you use as an example then gets distorted to then define what you may or may not be saying, or at least an incomplete version of what you're saying. And I think that it's almost inevitable for someone who is so forthright and explaining concepts in the abstract to have that. But I have to imagine that it has to come in as a surprise to you when you put your work out there and you clearly elaborate a point and provide examples that people who may be looking at this jump to something that's clearly an incomplete understanding of everything that you're trying to say.
Yeah, I think thankfully a lot of people have been very patient because, to your point, even with all of the culture references and stuff, I actually had a really good conversation with my grandma yesterday, and she thankfully liked the book. I thought she was going to hate the book when I wrote it because of all the swearing and all the, stuff at the end of the book. We can talk about that if you want to. But I think the other kind of stuff in terms of the book itself, she thought it was good, but the one really critique she had was that, she's like, Sam, there were so many things looping in and out and all that kind of stuff before you hit him with the sucker punch at the end. And so it wasn't really a, I would say, a big, thing about it. She liked the book, but I think it was just kind of hard to follow in a lot of cases, which I kind of want to write that way. That's kind of my style. It's kind of messy. It's not very like templated, all that kind of stuff. It loops in a lot of different things. And I think that, are there cases where some person might take it out of context that I mentioned somebody? Like, sure. And I think that they're, like, and I mention these people because I think that they have, again, can they add to the story or do they subtract from the story? And I think all of the people that I mentioned in the book add to the story in some way. So I think that, but I, and I think I do a pretty, I think a decent job of balancing that throughout the book. I wanted it to be a neutral book. So for example, in chapter two, I mentioned a, the agreement that was, I think the only agreement in the history of the world between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Tucker Carlson. So in an isolated bottle, if you put either of those two, mammoth people in a bottle, one group is going to love them and the other group is going to hate them. No matter what, everything else. But I'm like saying, no. Here is someone in AOC who you might think is just a crazy, wild leftist who wants to, like, take out all the oil refineries, all this other kind of stuff. And I'm going to take Tucker Carlson, this, like, Christian nationalist, like, what, fascist type of person, and I'm going to marry them together and say, no, we're going to talk about them together because they agree on something, not because they are going to do all this other kind of stuff. So people can take things out of context. I remember one of the only negative review I've gotten on Amazon, thankfully, has been with a woman who didn't like the way that I swore in the book. And she said, these values are not my values, and I don't really do all this other kind of stuff. I'm like, okay, good. You just proved my point in the book. Thanks for reading. And thanks for $5. So it's like, I really, in a way, a lot of them are helping prove my point. It's like, okay, your values aren't my values. Good. Like, good. Good. Like, I like go ahead and take your values and do whatever you want to do with them. That's what I'm encouraging that. But at the same time, is it, kind of interesting that people take it out of context? It can be, but I think that, the people, thankfully, that have read the book have taken everything very much in stride and in context, which has been a very, very big blessing to see for sure.
Yeah, and I think, if I may,
Sure.
instead of saying messy, the takeaway I got was non-linear. And
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tell you why I go with that. And I kind of want to jump to what you had teased a few moments ago, which was the ending. And I think that people will really get a kick out of it because
Yeah.
it's almost like you explain all these types of abstract concepts, you tie in pop culture reference, you're talking about this development that you're achieving, and then you really personalize it, but not in a way that is self-serving, but in a
Right.
way that's self-reflective. And what really stuck out to me, and I'm going to kind of get really into the weeds of here,
Go
so
ahead.
pl please, I would encourage anybody who's listening, open to this part of the book where he talks about the ending with Chris Farley. So the book
Yep.
begins with Chris Farley, it ends with Chris Farley, and it has in there towards the end this self-reflection on excessive masturbation. And you use anxiety, self-loathing, depression as words to describe that state. And it was really interesting how you talk about the internal reflection of your own actions with Chris Farley.
Yep.
And I'm curious to say, was that intentional? Did you want the readers to pick up that those two were related in some way? Talk about that.
I did. I did. And I think this is the, oh, by the way, this is the only way I will ever be compared to Chris Farley in my entire life, because I think that this was, and not because, like, I like to think I'm funny, but I'm definitely not as funny as he was, for sure. And so I think, like, back, we were talking earlier about, transformative experiences and kind of everything else. And I remember, like, there are very few moments that really, altered my perception of what I thought about something. And one of those moments in my childhood was, I was in middle school. I think I was about 13, I think, but, like, probably younger than now, so probably at 12 or 13 years old. And my parents are in their early 50s. And so when they were in college, and then they're in their kind of 20s, and kind of, you know, they've been dating since they were 16 years old, and they had been, you know, all throughout high school, college, and in their adult life together. And so they were on, they were looking and watching Saturday Night Live during that glorious time in the 90s, where if you look back at the roster of talent that was on, it was unbelievable. It was, you know, this is Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, David Spade, Dana Carvey, Mike Myers, Tim Meadows, Phil Hartman. I could Molly, later Molly Shannon, Will Ferrell, Jimmy Fallon, like all these people would come on, not at that time specifically, but they would come on later. Sarah Silverman was in that time as well. And so if you look at that roster of just titans of comedy and people that have just made me laugh so many times over the days, like I grew up on Adam Sandler movies. I remember when I was 9 years old watching Benchwarmers in the theaters with my dad and laughing my ass off the entire time throughout the entire movie. And so, but the one person I didn't know out of that cast was Chris Farley. And so, because they're all alive, and Chris Farley unfortunately is not alive at this point. And so I remember, and my parents, I was still, we were kind of talking about it. And so they brought home two DVDs from the local, this is when you still bought DVDs, two DVDs from the local store for like $10 a piece. One was the Saturday Night Live Best of Adam Sandler collection, and one was the Best of Saturday Night, or Saturday Night Live Best of Chris Farley collection. And so I'm like, I'm all in on the Adam Sandler one. I love Adam Sandler. I had no idea who Chris Farley was. And so I heard from them over and over again that, you know, Chris Farley was easily the funniest person on Saturday Night Live I've ever seen. He was so great. He was like unspeakably funny. And I remember my dad told me he had never laughed harder at anything in his entire life because he saw what turned out to be the, both the intro of my book and the famous Saturday Night Live sketch, the motivational speaker. He remembers the
Yep.
exact moment because he watched it live on Saturday Night Live back in 1993 or whatever it was. I think it was 1993. And he remembers he has never, he told me he had never laughed as hard as he did during that moment that he was watching that Saturday Night Live skit. And so I'm like, you know, I'm kind of poo-pooing it. I'm like, okay, like whatever. Like, you know, okay, it's probably funny, probably not that funny. And I laughed harder at that DVD than I've ever laughed, probably almost at anything in my entire life. I fell because, and Chris Farley to me was so funny that he was not, after a while, and I would watch him, like I was like, there's no way, like this is an hour of tape. There's no way he could be like this all the time. And I would look up all these other skits and of him. And I remember watching like Il Cantore, like the famous Saturday Night Live sketch where they would go in the Italian restaurant and Dana Carvey and Rob Schneider were inside of there and everything like that. And I'm like, he just like he doesn't stop and everything else. I was like, oh my God, like this guy's insane. So he transcended to me. Chris Farley no longer became a person. He became an entity. Like I couldn't believe, I was in awe of him. Like I couldn't believe how funny this guy was. And he just like he couldn't turn it off and everything else. And I remember reading Norm Macdonald's book, and I remember reading a bunch of other, you know, histories of all this other kind of stuff and watching all these documentaries. And I remember reading Chris Farley's book, The Chris Farley Show, which is written by his brother and another author, and doing all that kind of stuff and reading this. I'm like, oh my God, I just can't believe this guy's a real person. But what I didn't realize after a while was that Chris Farley was a remarkably sad and tortured individual in a lot of different ways. He was very insecure about his weight, very insecure, and he turned to alcohol, drugs, partying, you know, just general vices of society. And so and he eventually killed himself by overdosing in a Chicago hotel with a hooker for, you know, that, you know, on a speedball of cocaine and morphine. And he died, and she robbed him and left him basically OD'd on a hotel room. And when he was 33 years old, the same day that his, or the same age rather, that his idol John Belushi died. And which was just so ironic, twist of fate, whatever you want to call it. And I was so troubled by that. I was like, you know, how could a guy that is this good at something, like that is probably as good as making people laugh as anyone is ever good at, and like Warren Buffett, like stops, like as good at doing that, in my opinion, as someone else doing that in another field. How could that happen where he suffers such a tragedy in his life? And so I looked at it and I saw that he really didn't have an identity. He had a caricature. And he really didn't know what his identity was because he didn't have really any values. His only value was, I have to make people laugh all the time, every time, or else I am worth nothing. And he built himself up on that thing. And when he realized he started crashing and getting into trouble, he didn't have anything to base his life on. His life fell apart. And so relating that back to me, I was living a similar type of existence in a lot of ways. I didn't know who I was. I grew up tremendously insecure. I remember I was very insecure always around girls, around women, around you know, friends. I was kind of like a tweener between a lot of different groups. Like I wasn't very athletic, but I also wasn't very smart. Like I nearly failed out of college. I never really started in, you know, any sport in my entire life. People always beat me out. I was kind of floating in between these groups. I loved sports. I played football and track and field and weightlifting in high school, and then I did And then I wrote and I, read, second wave feminism in my AP, language arts class and stuff. So I really didn't, but I didn't really fit in anywhere. I didn't really fit in with that crowd. I didn't fit in with that crowd. So I developed a very narcissistic style of, I'm just going to please everybody all the time. And I'm just going to do whatever it takes to kind of get in with somebody. And hopefully somebody will like love me in return. Because I had a unique situation in my household as well, where my sister had autism, my brother had some learning disabilities. And so my dad traveled a lot for work, so I didn't get a lot of attention. So I kind of based the stuff out on my own. And I remember it after a while, I've developed this sense of like, I remember, I document in the book how I, found pornography at 10 years old, like unfortunately a lot of young men do now. And so I remember that was the one thing that really made me feel validated and loved, ironically, by a lot of people. And that developed into a very, very serious, and there's been debate on whether porn is an addictive substance around. My opinion it is, because I've lived through it. But I don't know if some people are saying like it's a compulsion, it's not an addiction, all this kind of stuff, which could be valid. I don't know the science behind it that well. But I developed a very, very serious, if at least compulsion, at worst addiction to pornography. I was watching about 2 hours of porn every single day, jerking off twice a day. I was isolating from everybody, all this other kind of stuff. I didn't have a life. I didn't know who I was. And so I remember, when I, kind of came out of this and I knew I wanted to talk about this because I wanted to both exercise that demon and also just tell people again, I'm a real person. I'm being real and I'm doing all this kind of stuff with people. And so in that kind of a sense, it was always the ability to kind of relate that to something else. And the way that I chose to relate it to when I heard the Chris Farley downfall, and I'm like, okay, I have a story to tell here. And I kind of can relate it to this person and also apply it in the context of the pop culture stuff we talked about earlier, where throughout the book, there's 10 chapters in the book, and I box in my free time to get in shape and all that kind of stuff. So it's kind of the thing where you're just kind of one-two-ing people to death. You're kind of death by a thousand cuts. And then I come in with the upper. And then chapter 10, I can't make the shit out of you and I knock you out.
Yeah.
And so kind of the climax of the book was kind of that revelation about the biggest insecurity I've ever had in my life, the most shameful things I've ever done in my life. I was looking at material that, and I've known a lot of guys that have, problems with pornography and everything, but I was so, degenerate. I was a degenerate. Like, I mean, I was watching women get physically abused, manipulated, humiliated in public, like all this kind of like just horrendously awful stuff. And it warped my perception about relationships, about women, about, what I want in a romantic partner, about everything. And I was terrified. And the way I kind of, did that in the real world was that I just didn't interact with women. I didn't interact with people because my perception of them was so fucked up that I didn't want to ruin it because I knew they wouldn't accept me if they looked behind the curtain and they said like, oh my God, this guy's a fucking, kind of a mess or whatever. And so that really kind of paralyzed me. And so that was a big thing in relating it to that. And it just came to a point where I remember I just got to a point where I'm just like, man, I'm so sick of this. Like, I remember I was disgusted with myself. I remember I hated the way I looked. I hated the way I acted. I acted towards my pornography addiction, towards my masturbation habits. I hated everything about myself. I didn't like my life. And I said, I really had to kind of do all this other kind of stuff. And so I basically, said I need to really strip everything down and figure out what I am and who I am and what I need to do about this. Because at the end of the day, I didn't know who I was. I didn't have an identity. And I found, I started writing. I started doing all this stuff. And it was a very therapeutic process in writing this book because it really helped fix a lot of that stuff. And thankfully I haven't gone back. So it's been very, very good for me in a lot of ways.
Nice. What was that initial incentive or inclination, however you want to describe it, to try writing? Why did it come to you? And then why did it stick? Because I know a lot of people, they'll say, well, I want to write, but it never sticks. It yeah. did with you. And what's the deal behind that?
So I think with me, it kind of comes more naturally to than some people, because your point, like a lot of people say like, oh, I want to write a book. I want to do this. And then, they realize it's really hard. Like, it's really hard at this point and, all this other kind of stuff. And, but the thing with me was going back to kind of the books and everything growing up in the movies, I loved writing. I wrote all the time when I was a kid. I'm not artistically inclined at all. I can't draw for shit. I can't paint. I can't do any of that other kind of stuff. And I remember just being, I wrote competitively as a kid as well. There was a club called Power of the Pen. I actually talked about it in the book in my local school district that really, was a creative writing club competition. And so I went in, I did all that stuff, and I did really well, and I made it to states. I was like top 45, young writers in the entire state of Ohio back in my day, all that other kind of stuff. And I found really an escape in literature and kind of, writing out my feelings and getting out all that stuff. Like I never kept a diary, I never really kept a journal, but I would always, it was always long form, it was always stories or talking about a topic or everything like that. And I wanted to do it because, and I wanted to do the blog format and then later the book because I was really inspired by the writing of Mark Manson, who also had a very famous blog, has a very famous blog, and is a very famous author. One of the probably wrote the biggest self-help book of, or the most successful self-help book of my generation, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which was published back in 2016. And I was like, okay, maybe this can help. I want to get back into writing. I might want to write a book, and I want to exercise those muscles again, see where I land on all this kind of stuff. And so it came naturally to me because it was something I always did and it's something I always like to do. And it's not a natural thing. You kind of have to work your way into it and kind of, I think, be a little, at least a little bit more naturally inclined to doing all that kind of stuff. But I think, it came more natural to me than doing anything else. Like I said, I can't sing or dance. Like I can't do any of that other kind of stuff. I'm not, I'm a basically a 6'2", barely evolved Neanderthal knuckle dragger type who can happen to type words into a keyboard and hopefully they make coherent sense. So it's kind of coming from a very unnatural place. Like I'm not the starving artist type who wears like 50 bandanas and like, lays on the side of the sidewalk. I live in Austin, Texas, so I meet all those people all the time and they're awesome. I'm just not one of those people. So it's just kind of the most natural way of expressing myself that I could, if that makes any sense.
No, and it clearly shows in your writing. No, I think this is very clear in your writing. It's a natural flow, even if you may feel like it is unnatural, it really does come across as very natural and authentic. And I guess let me maybe touch to that point because I think that would be of interest to a lot of people listening. Is it easy to come across sounding that natural in your writing? Or is there a lot of work that goes behind the scenes to make it look and flow that nicely?
Well, it's easy for me because I think I've gotten to a point where I'm very comfortable in sharing details about my life. And I have a saying that basically, like, especially in my blog and my podcast, there are times where I go after people and I kind of say, like, okay, I don't like what this person is doing, so I'm going to call out that I don't like what this person's doing. And I have a context or a saying in my writing, particularly in my book, when I wrote the book, was that I will never punch anyone in the face as hard as I will punch myself in the face. And so I basically said, and I think also it's being fair and also like, making sure that you're putting yourself out there as much as you are. And I think that invokes other people to be honest. And I think the other part of it is it's easy to say what you mean and basically put yourself out there when you know you're telling the truth. Like it would be easy to say on one hand, like, my life wasn't a mess. Like I wasn't really addicted to all that kind of stuff. Like I wasn't really kind of a piece of shit person. I really wasn't kind of borderline incel doing all that kind of stuff. Like I was actually fine. It's like, well, no. I mean, like I wasn't. I mean, I think when you are really honest with yourself about kind of the role you play in your own life and the responsibility you take in your own life, then it plays over and carries over into whatever you want to communicate to an audience, whether that be just an individual person or a book or a podcast or whatever that might be. It always carries itself into how you communicate with people. So I think it takes a lot of work. I mean, it really takes a lot of peeling back all of your trauma and all the stuff that really kind of, eats at you and saying like, yeah, like I am kind of a piece of shit in a lot of different ways. We're kind of all like that in a lot of ways. Like we kind of all don't like a lot of ourselves. I don't like a lot of stuff about myself, and I'm trying to fix some of that stuff about myself. But I think that in terms of it being easy, I say it gets easier. It never gets less. It never gets easy to be. It gets easier, but it doesn't get, less hard or less easy. I think it's too simple of an explanation. Like for example, I'm writing my second book now, and so I'm in the middle of. I'm about 40% done. I'm about 35% of the way done, and I'm writing about probably right now the single biggest, I would say, single biggest moment where I felt really low about myself in terms of a relationship with another person. And it's, I played a role in that. That was my fault because it's a relationship with a person. Like, I mean, I am in the relationship, therefore it is partly to mostly my fault that I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. And so that's not hard to write about. And it's not hard to write about how that person treated me or how I treated them because I didn't treat them, I would say, very well in a lot of ways either. But it becomes easier when you acknowledge the situation as it is, when you don't pull the wool over your own eyes and say like, okay, that was kind of just, just a silly mistake, all that kind of stuff. It's like, no, you fucked up, man. I mean, like, you really kind of messed this up and you screwed this shit up. And you have to look at it in that way. And so I think it's hard for a lot of people because a lot of people, naturally, including myself, don't want to acknowledge their own failures and their own shortfalls and all that kind of stuff. And it's, just self-preservation and protection, which is a very reasonable excuse. But I think that you will, there's a really good moment that I like to reference with a guy named Douglas Murray. I don't know if you know who Douglas Murray
I
is,
don't.
but Douglas Murray is probably, if not the bravest, one of the most brave people I've ever heard speak in my entire life. Douglas Murray is a huge hero of mine. And so he is a British, he now lives in New York, but he's a British author and commentator and all this kind of stuff. And he's absolutely fearless in the way he speaks. And I highly admire him for that. And so he is friends with Joe Rogan. He's gone on Joe Rogan show 3 times. And on the second time, he probably has the most powerful clip of any Joe Rogan podcast I've ever seen in my entire life, other than maybe like David Goggins or Jordan Peterson or somebody like that. So it's called, just look up Joe Rogan, Douglas Murray, Truth, and it should come up. But it basically, Douglas Murray tells the story of a, I'm actually Czech, so it works in a Czech,
Nice.
Czechoslovakian, so it works out. So he tells this leader of this, or the story of this Czech leader, Václav Havel, who was basically the kind of puppet president, I guess, in the communist regime in Czechoslovakia. And so they basically had a regime that was tyrannical towards people. And he tells a story about a guy who's a greengrocer. So he sells vegetables, basically, or fruit, or like, just basically plants. And so, or I think we have fruits or vegetables. And so he tells a story, and Václav Havel writes about it, Douglas Murray talks about it in the clip. And he tells about how the dictatorship, the communist dictators in Czechoslovakia would say to this person or say to these grocers, you have to ha hang the sign in your window that says, workers of the world unite, which is basically a communist symbol about kind of all this other kind of stuff. And so he said it was a little thing, but it wasn't a little thing. And he said, and what Václav Havel says in this piece that he wrote, which is beautiful, he says, it's not, the sign hangs there, but it hangs there as a sign of that person's subjugation to somebody else. And which is very, very true, because he didn't want to hang it. He basically said, he's like, you all you he's like, you just have to hang it. You have to hang it there. I don't care what you say, you have to hang it up. And he knew that it wasn't true. And he knew that it was a lie. But the people still did it anyway, because they were afraid of what uncovering the lie would do to them and their families, understandably so. And so he said, what the problem with agreeing to lies, most certainly about yourself, is that it doesn't just not tell the truth about what the situation is. It also demoralizes you, and it makes you feel less about yourself. It makes you feel like more of a shitty person because you're not telling the truth. And he says, even though it can be very hard to tell the truth, whether that be posting the black square on your Instagram, raising the fist, doing all this, doing the salute, whatever you want to do, the people that do not do that, when they know what's wrong, will feel much better about themselves, and they'll hate them for it. They'll do all this other kind of stuff. But internally, they will have an internal sense of satisfaction about themselves because they knew that no matter the pressure, no matter what they were feeling about a certain thing, no matter what the lie could do to their personal lives, they will feel more secure about themselves than the people who agree to those lies. And so, what I would say to people that are concerned about this or want to come authentic, what lies are you telling yourself? What are you agreeing to that you know is not true? And then really look into that, because if you do and you start to peel those back a little bit more, and it's going to hurt like a motherfucker. This is not a rip off the bandage type of thing. This is kind of uncoiling a lot of different stuff about all this kind of stuff, especially with th things you're really insecure about. And I would say the biggest way to come across with being authentic is to not lie to yourself, and don't lie to other people, because both are destructive and both are bad. So I would say, don't lie to yourself, because that really does a lot of damage both to yourself and to other people.
No, so when is that going to come out, or do you have some sort of timeline for all that? I know it might be a little bit early.
So I want to finish it by December, and it's looking to be on track for that time. So I'm going to be 4 chapters done after this week. It's going to be 10 chapters. Well, I guess 9 chapters, including the introduction to the book. And I'm kind of working, on a lot of stuff to kind of, I want to get the book right for, I want to get the product right first before I kind of be worried about all that other kind of stuff. So I want to make sure the writing is good and the book is good before I, kind of take it to market or whatever. But I think sometime next year, hopefully, would be ideal. And I want to kind of press that to make sure we don't lose momentum from value economics and everything like that, excuse me. But it's going to be different, but it's going to be a good different. I think it's going to be a topic that needs to be talked about and discussed. And I can't wait to get into it. I think it's going to, this book was kind of a safe, it's not a safe book, but it's kind of a relatively neutral, nicey nice type of thing in a lot of ways. But this book is going to be much more provocative in a lot of ways, which I'm really excited about. I'm taking a different scope on a different subject material. It's going to be totally not what the first book was. And I'm very, very much looking forward to that because I love writing about different things and unique things.
That's awesome. I guess let's leave it with this then, because I think
Yep.
we talked a lot about the book. You teased the new book that's coming out. I want to leave the audience with a few nuggets that I think that they can take away in listening to you and then eventually reading your book. There are a few takeaways that I think are salient points that anybody who reads your book should really get. And I think that they would go get a walk away better for it. Can you, if possible, maybe summarize a few of those nuggets that you want the reader to walk away with when they finish reading Value Economics?
Sure. So I would say the first one would be tell the truth. Don't lie to yourself, most importantly, but especially not to others, because that can hurt both yourself and to people. Tell the truth. Know what is important to you. That is the biggest thing. Know your values. Know what is important to you and anchor yourself into that kind of thing and that kind of structure, because I believe that it's the only thing that can sustain you long term is that if you anchor yourself in something permanent and everlasting. And that can be a value. And it doesn't have, you don't have to have my values, that point about the lady that hated my book in the Amazon comment. It doesn't have to be my values. It can be your own values. They have to be something. And it cannot be your gender. It cannot be your political affiliation. It can't be your sexuality. It can't be your skin color. It can't be anything that is a superficial sense of who you are as a person. It has to be something deeper than that. So knowing what your values are and telling the truth about yourself when talking about those values and expressing those values are probably the two biggest things. And also, I think it's important to present yourself authentically, because you know the biggest piece of the book, I almost issue it as a warning in the first part of in the first chapter of the book, is that when you adopt a concrete set of values, you are going to naturally polarize people, and you are going to alienate some people who maybe once were your friends, once were not your friends, all that kind of stuff. And you have to be okay with that, even though it's going to hurt probably in the future, especially if you haven't done it up to this point like I did. And however, there's a flip side to that. You're going to alienate people, but you're also going to attract people. You're going to attract people in that kind of a sense as well. So I think the biggest example for me personally was when I rededicated myself to Christianity last July. So I'm a Christian in my religious denomination. And I think there's a real aversion to talking about any religion in general, but I think particularly Christianity in America, where people are like, oh, that's just some Bible thumper who's going to like lecture me about how wonderful Jesus is or something like that. But and there's a lot of problems with that inside of my religion. There's a lot of that's what alienated me from it for so long, if I'm being really honest with you. But the thing that has been great about that was that it's allowed me to have conversations with people about the important things. It's allowed me to align with people on a personal level. I have friends now in my small group especially that are very, very good people, and I'm very, very glad that they're in my life, because if they weren't, then I wouldn't have a community in Austin, Texas. I didn't have a community out when I lived in Boston for the last, for me before I moved out to Austin. And now that I know what is important to me and both my values and all this other kind of stuff, and it's alienated a lot of people because a lot of people aren't Christians, and that's fine. And a lot of people don't have my values, and that's fine. But I've been able to deepen friendships with a lot of different people around issues such as that and other things like I box. I like to keep myself in shape. I like to, you know, go out and, you know, eat nice food and do all that kind of stuff. So I like to do that too. But you know, when you polarize people, you have to realize there's going to be a reward for that if you are honest and stick with it. And you have to, and you are expressive about it, because you need to express your values and your actions and your thoughts and what you say. And when you do that to people, you will be, I think, very pleasantly surprised with, after a while, after all the dust settles, the people you begin to attract in your life. And you'll begin to realize that your act of pleasing people will almost seem childish in a lot of ways, because it's like, you know, why were you pleasing someone that doesn't align with who you are as a person in the first place? And that's stupid. It's dumb. And so I would say, tell the truth, know what's important to you, and act on it forthrightly, confidently, and in a way that polarizes people constructively. You don't want to be the guy that's like, you know, I mean, you don't want to be a person that's like, you know, saying like, racial slurs and stuff like that. Like, that's obviously not okay, right? Like, saying like all these people need to like, go burn in hell or whatever. That's not good. But definitely have a sense of your value and your values, excuse me, and then polarize all of those things constructively, where you can have a way about doing things that is constructive to you in your life and the formation of your values.
Wow, well said. So with that, thank you, Sam. Thank you so much for your time. I encourage all of you who have made it this far into the podcast, please go out, purchase Sam LaCrosse's book, Value Economics, The Study of Identity. It is a great read and you will take away much with it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sergey. Appreciate it, man.
Thank you.